Hey, Pulp fans, thanks for your support. Whether you're subscribing to the podcast through iTunes, visiting pulpmx.com, streaming the show via the Stitcher app on your smartphone, or buying from our show sponsor, btosports.com, without you, we could not do this. You can still type M-A-T-T-H-E-S upon checkout at btosports.com if your order is $100 or more for a discount. Lastly, for some insider info and maybe a laugh or two, follow Mathis's Twitter updates at twitter.com/pulpmx.
This episode of the Steve Mathis Show, there is a high
chance ability
you will either learn something
a lot of people don't know,
you left thinking,
duh,
or make you say to yourself,
dude, that's so funny.
The bottom line is,
this podcast serves as archival
documentation
of this interview.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com Trans World Motocross Podcast. As usual, I'm your host, Steve Mathis, and with me on the line is a long, long time influential person in motorcycle racing, and now the head of a Honda R&D car and bike, Dave Arnold. Dave, thank you for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve. This will be fun. I've listened to your guys' show a few times, and it's actually quite it's an exciting concept.
Yeah, thank you. I don't even know where to start with you, man. There's so much we need to get to. But I guess right away, like I said, you're doing R&D now for Honda?
Yeah, that's right. I was in racing for 20 years. I've been with Honda for 36 years. And so, you know, the whole race thing, and as focused as we were and as much traveling, it takes its toll over a long period of time. And I thought, when I hit the 20-year mark, I moved over into new product development at R&D, new product testing. And at first it was motorcycle. Now they've combined motorcycle and car. So I'm helping the automotive guys build, kind of running the machine and fab shop.
Yep.
For auto, and they mainly facilitate model. It's a design thing. They build really nice models, really nice shop.
Uh-huh.
And then we're still doing a lot of the prototype skunk work stuff for the motorcycle division.
Right. How much do you get over to the race shop and BS with Gary Martini and Eric Kehoe and those guys? How much does that
happen?
You
know, I still go over quite a bit. I mean, motorcycle's always been my passion. It was my passion and hobby as I was growing up as a kid. And then I made the career out of it, but it was still that the whole time I was in racing, and even now I'm in auto. I go back over to the race shop, I don't know, every week, every other week, and
Right. Kick
things around and just say hi to everybody and try to get in their way a little bit.
Yeah, maybe you can fire Shane Drew for me. That'd be awesome.
I'll help those guys work on that.
Yeah, old friend of mine from back in Canada, so just throw that out there.
Shane does a good job. Suspension's a big part of their program, and we talk quite a bit.
And then also, how much do you keep up with today's racing? Are you one of those guys that is known on what's going on every weekend, or...?
You know, it's kind of both. You know, it's racing was never really a social thing for me. I mean, when Honda, you know, when I got involved, the Japanese were, I mean, I don't classify it as anything else but corporate war, and there was a bunch of espionage, and it wasn't recreational. I mean, it maybe started out that way in the 70s as a new sport and as a developing sport,
right?
You know, because, of course, it came from Europe and all that, but it didn't take long for the Japanese to, all of them, want to make their mark and you know, develop the hardware and create the image and advertise the win. And so it was never really that recreational for me. I mean, it was You know, at Honda, Mr. Honda was still alive, and those project leaders were getting slapped around by him and directly, and they were slapping me around directly, and
right.
we had a lot of pressure on us to win. So
yeah,
and therefore, when I got out of it, it's not, you know, it's kind of like a drug or something. You know, you almost stay away just because you can't really sustain. You know, when you were doing it, it was such a high stress deal that you don't go back for, I have a lot of good friends in racing, but I probably don't go back as much as I should.
Well, my next question was how much do you miss it? But I think you answered that.
You know, there's a lot of things I miss about racing. I mean, I guess you call it the real world, because racing really isn't the real world, right? I mean, racing is a very unique activity, but there's a couple things I really miss about racing. One is you work around real thoroughbred people that, from the mechanics or riders, everybody, the R&D test guys, everybody has to be hitting on 8 cylinders, committed 100%. They can't be focused on their own internal issues or schedules and needs as much as they are the bigger goal.
Right.
And you know, it's very, very true in racing that you're only as strong as your weakest link. And when you go other places within corporations or even job, you know, you find that a lot of people, you know, you never really get to push people to that weakness like you do in racing. And I miss that. I miss the real committed, the real focus on, I guess the challenge of racing. I really miss that. It's a real,
right.
It's kind of a drug again. I mean, you really get wound up and it kind of takes a hold of your whole activities.
Right. I did one of these with Rich Taylor and your name came up a few times, just because of the R&D,
right.
and everything else. What an interesting, podcast that was, but
yes.
Now you're working on that end of things. If I had told a 1977 Dave Arnold that in 2010, there's going to be EFI and we're all going to be racing 4-strokes, what would you have thought?
You know, I've actually, personally, I've always been a 4-stroke guy, ironically, and
yeah.
I was really into British bikes as I was going through, because British bikes, that was kind of the thing. I mean, there was Triumphs and BSAs, and even when, you know, as the 4-strokes, let's say, everything was a 4-stroke then, as they started to get obsoleted by, you know, the Husqvarnas and the Makos and the CZs and all those things, you know, I always really, And then I started working for Honda, and then, of course, you're as deep as you could ever be, working with engineers in Japan on, at first it was piston port engines, and then case reeds, and then reed valves, and then, you know, all these, and then rotary valves, and then exhaust valves, and into all these systems. I mean, as the whole engines evolved and all the technology
right.
was developed, I had a soft spot, you know. In the 70s, there was still some guys riding CCMs and Works BSA, John Banks and a few guys like that, Dave Vickers.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, when Husaberg, you know, and even when, I think, even when 2-strokes were at their peak in the 70s and 80s, I still think that there was a lot of us that, man, if we could ever make a lightweight 4-stroke, like Husaberg finally did, right? I mean, I think everybody wanted a 4-stroke that was built in the same, the same effort, the same lightweight compact as 2-strokes evolved into.
Right.
And then, you know, of course, everybody followed Husaberg, you know, Yamaha and then all the factories. And some of that was tied to, you know, the EPA and, you know, off-road and, you know, I think the government and the local agency, regulatory bodies, they didn't take them long to figure out that everybody was riding 2-strokes in the deserts instead of XRs, so.
Yeah, right, right. But it's pretty amazing where we've come in this span of 4-strokes.
It totally is, and to be honest, I'd have to say that except for EFI, I'd have to say that there is, I don't want to say that when we were doing it, it was all cool and we did all the big developments, and then there was nothing, because it's not that way, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, during the late 70s and especially the 80s, I mean, that's when everything,
right.
I mean, that's when the factories really changed the castings and the chassis geometries to accept long travel, and the chassis rigidity went way up, and the engines got much more compact, and the engines made much broader power bands. And
mm-hmm.
I'd almost have to say that I don't want to say it got boring, but I always really liked the development of the hardware, and it really, really slowed down after, I'd say, going into the 90s.
Right.
And I would say there's been almost nothing new from that period. And, yeah, there's been little things, but we joke at work that it's the difference between all the bikes is like a sticker kit and a paint job now.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And until fuel injection. So now Husaberg has their Husqvarna now. You know, they did some things with the engine configuration. Now Yamaha turned that around. I mean, my hat's off to those. At least those developments are a little bit out of the box, and people are trying some things new again. So.
I agree. Yeah, the Yamaha bike seems to be a hot and cold bike as far as whether you like it or not, but I applaud them for thinking outside the box a little bit, you know?
Oh, no, totally. But having said that,
when I was at Yamaha, we had that four-stroke, and we obviously, as you know, we all know, all the OEMs buy each other's bikes and look at them. When I was at Yamaha, we had our four-stroke. You guys came out with your four-stroke in, what was it, 06? 07?
I think it was 06, but I'm probably off a year or two.
Right, and we got that thing, and we were like, oh, man. You know what I mean? Because it was lighter, skinnier, faster.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just, not to bag on Honda for not coming up with the Yamaha model, but you guys sort of put the world of four-stroke on its ear with your first CRF, too.
You know, I can tell you, you know, I'm going to hear about this in weeks to come when I go back to the company, but it was always, with all the Japanese, and I worked at Honda, so especially Honda, I mean, they really wanted to be first with all those big developments. And, you know, the four-stroke thing was a hard nut for Honda to leave because, you know, they have standards for the development of all these things. I mean, every company does. And maybe they're a little bit different. It's all kind of trade secret for that particular company. But, you know, Honda was developing two-strokes for motocross and four-strokes for off-road. Now, you know, two-strokes, if I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but people, they don't ride those things for the Baja 1000 as much as they do going to local racetracks, and they don't put the hours on them, and they service the air cleaner at shorter periods of times and put a new piston and ring and all that, and things are made to be more compact, lightweight, you know, for course-type competition. And then the XRs were made more for the real endurance thing. They had standards that were quite different for off-road, for Baja, Bruce Ogilvy, desert stuff, than the motocross stuff. And, you know, just to say, hey, we want to make a four-stroke like the two-stroke, I mean, Honda, you had all these engineers that were trained and they had all these standards for developing all these desert, Baja, ultra-durable, long-distance engines, and then, you know, you're going to make something that's just half the weight and you know, of course if you're of course they're going to explode and of course they're not going to last and have the same durability standards as maybe an XR would have maybe 10 years ago, but Yamaha, you know, they always told us there's no way in hell, and then Yamaha comes out with it and then they're probably poop on it for 6 months and then pretty soon it's the reality of, oh my, we better get our act together, you know.
Well,
the bottom line is they like to lead, and that was one example of them not being able to lead, and and it really caused some ripples within the company.
Yeah, they got pissed, and they came up with a lighter, faster, quicker turning version of the Yamaha four-stroke. You know, it's just no secret in racing what goes on. I mean, all the other models are in the back of the shops, you know, and all that, and people are looking.
Yeah.
At them.
And sometimes to be first is the biggest risk because.
Right.
You know, once you create that investment for all those molds and all of that casting and all those frame fixtures, and I mean, you don't really get to change them every year. And then once everybody kind of looks at what you did, and then, you know, you're out there racing the thing week in and week, even when it's a works bike, they can kind of look at what you did right and wrong and where they want to do it a little bit different. And it's always easier to follow and then try to up the ante a little bit.
What, in your opinion, like with two strokes, what if we had never discovered four strokes, if the AMA had never put in a double the CC limit rule that really started the ball rolling, if the AMA had never done that, what was the next thing coming on two strokes? What were we going to do, in your opinion? Was there going to be like direct injection or something?
I think they were looking at direct injection. They were looking at all kinds of things. I mean, Honda built, I think they called it an AR, and they raced it off-road. And they had a bunch of engineers that were involved for HRC two-stroke engine, motocross engine development. And they had them work on, when all this movement went to four-stroke, they said, okay, what if we never did that? What if two-strokes had to comply to all these same emission standards, and what if two-strokes evolved, and they built prototypes, they worked on developing that hardware, and the bottom line is those two-strokes, a very simple engine, right, as you know it, right? Well, once they developed two-strokes that had an exhaust port that was, or a combustion chamber, a combustion system that was much more efficient, like a four-stroke, well, essentially, it was just as complicated as a four-stroke, and it had as many parts. And so then maybe even it ran super lean. It was on the verge of detonation and needed all this engine management to, and, you know, then at that point in time, it wasn't quite the pleasurable experience that maybe just even having a four-stroke would be. So
You were losing the soul of a two-stroke.
Yeah, exactly.
How much did you have to, now talking about being first for Honda, their 97 CR250 with that aluminum frame was, you know, it blew pretty much everyone out of the water, but it wasn't the best bike. Just handling and chassis. I mean, I was a local pro. I rode my buddies. I hated it, but whatever. How much do you regret about that bike and working with that bike? And do you think you missed the mark to this day? Or talk about the development of that thing.
Yes, you and I are the guys that want to buy the product and go to the track and do direct comparisons. And I think to a manufacturer like Honda, they're looking at a bigger picture than sometimes it's hard, even being involved in development processes, for us to understand. And they knew that that chassis was way too stiff. I mean, they know the rigidity. All these manufacturers, they know how the torsional and lateral and bending centers and everything, they know how their chassis and how much compliance and flexibility and control and G-force and, you know, they have engineering and science that goes into the development of all this product. There was a trend of chassis rigidity, we'll just say, you know, for steel chassis prior to aluminum chassis. But and the aluminum chassis was off the top. It wasn't comparable in any way. And therefore, it had the over-the-top, the compliance and bump impact and some of the deflection issues. But to Honda, in the big picture, if they tried to focus more on the performance issues and try to make it directly comparable. I mean, yes, lighter and stiffer, but let's say the thing had durability issues, they never would have been able to recover. It would have ruined the image of aluminum chassis.
Right, good point.
So they were going to overbuild it. Even to do that type of welding with robots in mass production is a mouthful, right?
Right.
And they have to study, well, you know, steel, they just put MIG welding and a bunch of heat, and it's quite a bit easier in mass production. But when you start talking, you know, TIG welding, and a lot of it, some of it's MIG, some of it's TIG, some of it's hand welded, and it has to be cosmetic, and they know exactly the tolerance of a good weld and a bad weld by these robots, so they'd have to go through the development of aluminum chassis by making the entire chassis with really bad welds, you know, worst case scenario. And so the bottom line is they knew exactly what they were doing, even if they got bagged on a little bit. I mean, there was the newness of it all. People bought that stuff. And then at the end of the year, they were like, man, those bikes were super fast, if you remember, right? They had the power valve on them or that power jet in the carburetor. But then I think over the next course of a few years, you know, then they knew if they cracked and was that within, I mean, how many did they have to replace and did that fall within acceptable levels? And then they started to, over the years, they've started to make the beam smaller and a little bit thinner and then the flux a little bit more. And it was all on purpose. And it was just, it was overbuilt because they didn't want to have problems the first year out. If they had problems, people would have said the stuff was garbage, and then it never would have evolved.
And you could make a point, you know, a few years back, Suzuki had a problem on their brand new RMZ 450. It wasn't related. It was a case failure, I think. I think they had a kickstart problem, and they had something else go wrong. And you can make a case that Suzuki has still not recovered from that. It didn't get released. Yeah. It didn't really get released to the magazines for the shootouts.
Yeah.
Therefore, it didn't sell. And, you know,
this is every company, I think, they've got a DNA. They have something that they go, this is us, and this is something we're going to do really well.
Right.
And, you know, the Japanese, in general, if you throw a blanket over them, I mean, they build really good quality product and at a pretty reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting a lot of technology for that dollar. I mean, if you really look at how much technology goes into a dirt bike, it's unbelievable. Cartridge forks and fuel injection and exhaust valves and all this stuff.
Right.
Suspension systems and the whole bit, how compact, lightweight. But you know, Honda's DNA was reliability. And if they're reliable for 10 years and then they have 1 year where they're not, well, then people, you know, you lose that reputation pretty quickly.
Right, right.
And, you know, Suzuki, maybe you can think of Suzuki and you go, wow, they do really good at sport bikes. And then Kawasaki maybe does, you know, really good at this area. But that whole reliability thing, you know, even when, like in the case you brought up the 97, even when it nicks, like, performance in some way, you know, like
right.
Let's say those chassis were a little bit too stiff the first year,
mm-hmm.
they didn't break, right? And that's and Honda wants to hang their hat on that, so
that's a good point. And
and
it's funny how much you think about Honda lawnmowers, cars, generators, anything Honda makes
yeah.
is reliability.
Yeah.
That is really their hallmark.
That's yeah. for the, you know, and they're not just selling dirt bikes, and of course. You know, we're getting real critical in the magazines, the press, and of course we're enthusiasts and we're looking at every angle and we're looking, factoring in styling and we want to have factoring in the latest rider and the fashions and the, you know, the,
right.
the, how they're doing at the track. But, you know, these some of these companies, you know, they're selling, like you said, generators and street bikes and lawnmowers and cars and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To them, it's a bigger picture.
How much are you worried about the costs of these new four strokes and across the board for everybody? Like you said, you're getting amazing technology, but how much are you worried that it's, you know, there's a lot of two stroke, four stroke talk. People are wishing. Obviously, they voted with their wallets, and we're racing
yeah.
four strokes now.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
How much? And I mean, obviously, you're a company guy, and you can't. I mean,
yeah.
you don't want to talk about it.
No, I mean, I'll tell you straight up. I like the cool factor of four strokes, but then these companies, and everybody wanted that.
Right.
Everybody wanted what we have, right?
Yep.
And there was one person that said, but you know, once you have it, then you go, well, wow, the cost to maintain this stuff when it does wear out. A lot of parts, and there are a lot of expensive parts, and
mm-hmm.
and that's a reality of that I think that we're just going to have to deal with. I mean, I think that there'll be kind of a happy medium, whether or not titanium valves and all the
right.
like castings, maybe they compromise that stuff a little. And then the pure cost of it all, too. I mean, even developing any product in Japan right now, just the yen the way it is, everything is expensive. And who knows? I'm not an expert about world economies, but all this stuff is cyclical, right? It kind of
yeah.
goes up. It kind of goes down. And
Do you see a day?
I don't know. I mean, I would have to say that the cost of maintaining the four-stroke is more than maybe we all fit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now the cost of maintaining all that technology is, when the stuff does get time on it, is more than we thought it would be. And I don't think it was a surprise to Honda. I think it's a surprise to all the consumers.
Yeah, yeah. No.
And then I would have to say the other thing that was a reality is the noise issue of four strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, two strokes, we all thought two strokes were loud. And I had engineers saying, yeah, but four strokes, actually, even though it's a different decimal level and pitch, I mean, the actual pulse character is quite a bit more damaging and travels quite a bit further. And
right.
So I think that both those issues will, I think, but the market, even if the fact you're talking about it, you know, and customers do vote with their wallet, those, you know, it'll be addressed in the long run. I mean, if there's bikes that have exceptionally high maintenance, you know, more than some of their competitors, people are going to figure that out over time.
I mean, I'm sure in 1984, if you had said, hey, we're all going to be racing four strokes, you would have said, no way, they're too heavy, they're too slow, there's no chance, right?
Maybe there's some truth to that. I even remember when some of the higher level technology even came into two strokes. I mean, electronic power valves
mm-hmm.
and just a higher level sophistication, an increased level of technology, right?
Right.
And I'm not saying, you know, I'd have to preface this by saying I'm more of an analog guy than I am a digital guy, right?
Right.
I mean, I am that. But I kind of think that I looked at all the, I don't want to say blue collar, that's got a negative connotation, but I mean, people work on these things, and when you really start to ramp up sophistication for how, you know, and I was always kind of the one in the process, or at least one voice in the process going, you got to be careful because the people working on these things, I mean, you take your basic two-stroke, right? I mean, you pull the tank off, you pull the pipe off, you pull the cylinder off, you replace the reeve valves sometimes, and then the piston sometimes, and you put a fresh set of rings in it, and that thing's got, you know, a fifth of the horsepower back, right?
Right.
And it's a fresh engine. And but anyway, they're very, very simple to work on, and I really am still to this day. I like to get as much performance at the simplest equation.
Right, right. Well, we've all got buddies who have never touched their four strokes. They've never adjusted their valves. You know what I mean?
You know, I got two things to say about that.
Right.
And the one is, I don't know that that's all two-stroke, four-stroke. I mean, a part of it is. I don't know to what level. I mean, you could probably debate that for quite a period of time.
Yeah.
But also, I think that I think that there's less vocational education in schools. I mean, I think that kids, it's more of a throwaway society I'm a carpenter, so I do carpentry, but I don't work on my dirt bike. I mean, it used to be that, I'm not saying all the baby boomers, but there's some truth that, you know, everybody had to work on their cars at one time. Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm 35.
Everybody worked on their own V8s and changed their oil and adjusted their valves and in the 50s and 60s. And then pretty soon they put all, you know, when the smog regulation came along, nobody could do that anymore.
Right.
So I don't know where I'm going with that other than I'm not sure everybody would work on, even if they weren't as complicated. I'm not sure that the whole mentality of the current generation is I think people just assume take it to a local shop and get it worked on.
Yeah, maybe so.
I mean, but it's a point well taken. Look at cartridge forks.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you remember when you used to be able to take forks apart and they had a rod with a hole and you checked the oil height, you put seals and bushings, and you were done, right?
Right.
That's kind of like your two. Then look at cartridge forks. I don't even like to rebuild cartridge forks.
Right. Well, now you're twin chambers now. So you.
That's what I'm. That's what I'm saying. So I mean, you know, I probably, I'm the first one. I mean, it's that everybody wants that performance. Well, they want compliance. They want that total level of progressivity. They want that bottoming level. You know. Mm-hmm. Resistance capability, and then they want that resistance to fade. You know what I mean? And that dictates the technology, right? A lot of times that requirement or customer expectation for performance, and a lot of it comes, you know, you have a production regulation now. You used to be able to, you had a works bike, and then your production bike could have a simpler level. It kind of had the same image as some of the works race equipment, but it could be cheaper and simpler, right?
Right, right.
But, you know, you're selling stuff to the average customer that is what Ricky and Bubba and you know, it's what those guys demand.
So, in a broader scheme of things, was the production rule that brought in 1986, was that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's hard to say. I would say that the factories did not, and it's crazy to say this, but there's a couple different ideas I have about that. One is the factories were not doing a very good job at limiting their own spending.
Right.
And it was almost like they couldn't even afford to keep the, even Honda, I don't even think Honda, there was a recession in the middle of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
They could not afford. It was corporate war, and they all had egos out of control. And it just got to where, I mean, we had equipment that cost a lot of money. I think all the factories did, and it just got to be, I mean, you're not selling dirt bikes to support that, so it was more for image, and it was more for ego, and it was more maybe to create, you know, some kind of a position in the market to where people would buy all this other product. I'm not even sure, right?
But,
you know, but on the other hand, the promoters always thought that production regulation, the reason that the top riders won was because they had all the special equipment.
Is that what they thought?
That's a bunch of bull, in my opinion.
I agree. But that's true, though? That's
top,
what they thought?
The top guys, they get the good contracts. They get the Roger and the Mitch and at one point in time, a Dave for what that was. And, you know, they get that whole deal. They get the whole team structure. And the team, it's not even the equipment per se. It's the team's know-how for the setting of, it's not even a static, it's a dynamic. The setting of the bike, the team that knows how to change the settings from Carlsbad to Southwick to Supercross. But, you know, the whole, I think there was a lot of pressure from the promoters that even today, I think in road racing, if we take all the factories out and all the top riders out and all the special equipment out, then it'll be like NASCAR, right?
Right, right.
So, I don't know. I don't believe that. And from a standpoint, too, that a rider on a motorcycle, on a motocross bike, is probably about 70% of the total performance. Whereas, you know, in NASCAR, and there's some really good drivers, but they're not 70% of the total performance, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, they can pull on the steering wheel and lean and all that as much as they got big wavos for sure,
yeah.
But they're not 70%. The crew chief and who's deciding when to change tires, and it also is a big factor.
Yeah, well, when you're 50 years old, 50-something, like Mark Martin, and you're still winning, to me, that kind of takes away the athletic performance of the sport a little bit.
That's exactly right. Exactly, yeah. Right.
I mean, not, but like you said, the credit, kudos to those guys. So when you go to a Supercross now, Dave, I don't know if you go at all, but what's your thoughts? Factory Yamaha doesn't have a team, and there's naked girls, and... You know,
yeah. Hey, you know what's kind of funny about this is now I'll get in trouble with the wife when I go home. But you know, Roger and I, for me personally, in the '80s, I don't think the sport was really marketed, or I really thought the promotion of the sport could be quite a bit better. And I remember seeing Rocky 1 or 2, and remember the girls that came out with all the glitter, and then holding up the cars, and then they could barely walk. Remember all that?
Yeah.
And it was, of course, that was a Sylvester Stallone boxing movie, and I would tease Roger, not to be sexist or anything else, but I go, if I was a promoter, that's exactly what I would do, right? I would have them walking across the starting line at Glen Helen in high heels, and that, I mean, my God, is that dream was fulfilled, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're an innovator, Dave.
yeah. No, I didn't have anything to do with it, but from a standpoint of, but on the other hand, there's a tiny bit of sleaze, I don't know if motocross was ever a pure family sport, but now I'm like, man, there's a lot of TNA going on, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And which is not all bad. I mean, you got to look at, I'm not 20 years old either, man. When I was, and it's not that I don't like it now, I'm 56, you know. I mean, I'm not going to say I don't like going, but then when you're thinking about bringing your wife and kids, you're going, well, I don't know if I'm going to go to the pits or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
But the other side I think of is, I think the sport, I don't know, it's just different. I'm not going to say it's good or bad. I mean, because...
It is different. You're
I don't
right.
think yeah. the factories... I think the... You know, Honda put a lot into motocross. The development, not only the development of the hardware, but the sport itself. I mean, to fund these big efforts in Europe and in U.S. and to pay the riders' salaries and to pay the mechanics and have the shops and, you know, they're making an investment in the sport. It's... I don't want to get all holier than thou about this, but I think the Japanese truly wanted the sport, you know, of course, maybe for selfish reasons, but also, you know, they wanted outside sponsors. They wanted, you know, I think they may not have known how that relationship was going to pan out with outside sponsors, but they wanted the sport to grow and get more, and that was only going to showcase their hardware, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that that's what everybody wanted. Now, me, when you ask that question, I mean, you know, the period that I was involved, the 70s and 80s and part of the 90s, where the focus was the hardware development, I mean, I really think I lucked out, because that's truly what I got my enjoyment out of, you know, the challenge of developing a better mousetrap or more power or a better handling chassis or more dynamic balance and whatever it is, right? I mean, and to try to, it's still the rider's 60%, but if your bike, nobody tested more than us. I mean, I'm not to be disrespectful, but there was a period of time in the 80s that nobody could have tested more than Honda and developed more.
Right.
Well, I don't know, maybe made, you know, you learn by your mistakes, and we certainly, we you know, it's, and so I would say that the era where the 70s and 80s where we did all the development, I think that was, I learned the most, and I think it was the most personally gratifying for me.
Right.
And now when I go, now the sport's different. I don't say it's, you know, gosh, look at the monster, look at the happening, right? It's a social frickin' happening, right? It's
it
a
is,
show.
Yeah.
So I think that that's brought, like, increased level of exposure and publicity, and it's a lifestyle thing now. I mean, I don't ever think it was a lifestyle before, right? Other than a bunch of gypsy guys,
you know,
traveling around in box vans and you know, parts flown in and out and... You know,
yeah,
I think we had more flexibility with the box vans to go testing quite a bit more while we were on the road. The relationship between management, mechanics, the technical guys, riders, I mean, we were pretty much all in the same bed together, right?
Yeah. No.
And I think that that's quite a bit different nowadays with semi-trucks, and mm-hmm. you got an R&D guy in California or wherever the base is, and then he comes up with something. The mechanic may or may not have been involved in that, but he's got to bolt it on, and then the right, you know what I mean?
Yep.
I think that there's, but that's just, I'm not saying that's bad, it's just different. I mean, you know, I'm really grateful that I was involved for the period I was involved in.
Right, yeah, and back then you just had Hannah glaring at all the spectators from the back of his box van.
Oh, yeah. Jeez, oh, Pete. We had...
Hey, what do you, as an R&D guy, man, we're half hour in, we haven't even got to the racing and this stuff, but,
Say what?
All right, I don't know if you were at a NASCAR race or not.
no, I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, no, I just heard, I didn't say anything, I waited for that noise to go away.
Oh, that was a VW, the guy was, like, chirping the wheels, drag racing, somebody threw a stoplight here.
Nice. As an R&D guy, when you read the magazine tests of a bike that you've been developing for years and maybe they missed the mark on it, or how frustrating is it to read the magazine tests of these bikes?
You know, I think I was in racing, and there was a while I was in production development, mm-hmm. and you know, in racing, there was, you know, these companies are big. Honda's bigger than most all these other companies, and right. even when you're in racing, you're you got it all figured out, and this works really good for Stanton, or it works really good for Jean-Michel Bale, or Ricky Johnson, or Jeremy McGrath, right? And then, you know, you go back to the guys that are developing production bikes, and they kind of not blow it off, but they're going, well, that's a special, much different than the average customer requirement. So they might give you some consideration, and you might have a certain level of influence, but you certainly... You know, they have limitations of cost or something else. I mean, even the type of settings, and there's even legal issues that impact mm-hmm. settings of production bikes, right? Like, won't even get into it, but what if the guy bolts on the wrong tire and, you know, it hits the plastic, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All this tire clearance to plastic. It's production bikes are slightly different than race bikes.
Right.
But in any case, when we were winning races, like, and we had a pretty good streak going from 1981 through Jeremy and through Carmichael. And not all those years did they win the magazine stuff. So, you know, I guess there was some pride that in the good years and the lean years, we always were able to understand what we were given, what we had as a base, and where it needed to go to satisfy high-level racers, right? And we had enough influence on the production process that, at least as a base, we would get that. Whether or not that base had the perfect setting for the average customer, I mean, was almost immaterial to us then. I mean, of course, I would have liked for the company to win all the shootouts at the same time, but... Yeah, you know, even now, and if they don't do it now, it's like, well, you know, if they would have asked me, I would, or, you know, you get into all that stuff, right?
Yeah. So,
I'd have to say I'm probably brainwashed and Honda loyal enough that anytime they're not winning races or winning magazine shootouts, it bothers me in some way, yes.
Right. Okay, yeah, I know, talking to Rich about it, you know, he said some guys were completely clueless, and some guys nailed it right on. He's like, it was really frustrating.
And on that note, and not that that was a self-serving comment from Rich, but Rich did a really good job. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not up to one guy. It's almost up to even a crew chief on a race team. I mean, a Roger, you know, or a guy leading production development. I mean, you know, a Rich Taylor or a Roger, there's not one riding style that is the perfect riding style that's completely center of the market. There's not one opinion that is the best opinion. But, you know, it's your responsibility as a crew chief leading that development I view the best crew chiefs that handle all those production bike development is not the guy that thinks he knows the most, but the guy that is able to, I call him a sponge, or I think of him as a sponge. He's able to take all that in,
right.
And he's able to factor a Rich comment like, well, Rich Taylor, he's pretty good in all these areas except for his fork setting. There's no way the average guy would ever want something that stiff.
Right.
And, I mean, you have to be right about that, but you have to kind of have a judgment about what you're willing to accept and not accept from a Rich Taylor or a Roger or anybody, right?
Yeah.
And then you end up with a good production bike. And sometimes the worst production development is when even companies, they go, we're going to develop this new mousetrap, and theoretically it's going to do all this wonderful stuff, but what happens in that process, and even Honda, you know, they go, you know, they're looking at some, let's say like this new Yamaha, you said some people love and hate it. Sometimes when you look at those big developments, that mass centralization, we're going to move the motor, you're looking at one aspect, but in reality, and maybe theoretically it's better, and maybe even for the long run it will evolve to be the superior technology, but in the short run, you have to balance that out with, it's not all about having the most agile bike. It's got to be stable. It's got to be dynamically flat. It's got to be able to turn. It's got to be compliant. It's got to jump flat. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's got to do all those things. It can't do six of those things really good and four of those things really bad.
It's got to do all
10 of them reasonably well, and that's the best setting. And sometimes when you're Honda, you're making these changes based on some theoretical statement or direction, you know, sometimes it's pretty easy to miss that overall balance.
Right. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Now it's time to pay some bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped to anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at btosports.com.
So I'm taking it, the magazine stuff, like Rich had an opinion, a strong opinion about the magazine tests. You're okay. As a crew chief guy, you take some hits and you realize it's kind of just part of the game, I guess.
Well, I didn't develop those bikes. I mean, anyway, I'm over in auto, and I'm not that closely connected to the latest ones, and so I'm not...
But I mean,
Rich is probably more accurate opinion than I even have right at the moment.
Well, I meant, but back in the ones that you did develop, you know, the ones that you did work with.
So your point was what then?
Well, just like you, when you were working heavily with R&D bike stuff, you didn't take the magazine test to heart, say, as much as Rich. You realized?
No, honestly, I really did.
Oh, okay.
Let's take a Jody, you know. Like, Jody's a very controversial person, and I've heard people go, well, Jody, he's freaking in left field. And you know what? Jody has a lot of, he's got a lot of background, and he's, everybody's got ego, you know, and I'm sure people would say, well, maybe Jody, maybe he's got an exceptionally strong ego. But I look at it quite differently. I mean, I think it's our job to understand what, Jody has a strong opinion. What is it that he likes and doesn't like? And how centered is that to the market, right? And
right.
And I won't say that, like, a Dave setting or a Jody setting, I mean, I won't say that if I set up the bike perfectly for me, I'm not saying that would be the best setting for mass production. But I still would respect Jody's opinion or any magazine editor, Rich Taylor, because as long as you understand, you know what I'm saying? You gotta do a better job next time of factoring that in. And then there's certain times where, you know, let's say I remember Jody was commenting about conventional forks. Well, there's a lot of things that conventional forks did better than even upside down forks, but I still would not have taken that to heart because the market and all the other demands on the bikes, whether it be torsional rigidity or whether it be bump impact, you know, I mean, you can argue that standpoint from a vet, right, standpoint of a guy that's 50, 55 years old, right, and fatigue's a bigger issue, but if you look at the bike targeted for a higher, medium, higher level motocross guy, right, and Carmichael's not going to race with conventional forks, right?
Right.
So I think you just have to understand where the comment's coming from, and I think you have to respect all input, good. I'm not going to say there is any good and bad input. You just have to know what the biases are and where the stuff is coming from.
Right, right. Yeah, I did one of these with Ross Maeda, and you know he swears that you can get conventionals to work as good as Upside Downs, but it was just a marketing thing, and so.
From what standpoint? I mean, from a Ross standpoint, again, I mean, Ross is at Ross's level. Now, again, I don't even believe it was a pure marketing standpoint. At the end of the day, yeah, yes, there's pressure and there's always new gadgets and all that stuff, right? But at the end of the day, that was a nice Corvette that just drove by, 62. Anyway, at the end of the day, Carmichael probably would have raced, and Jeremy, with whatever fork, he could have chosen whatever fork he wanted for that bike.
Right.
Maybe he would have got a little bit of static, but if he really could have gone around the track faster with conventional forks. But you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect, once riders got used to the bottom of the fork leg not dragging in the rut, I mean, Jeremy wouldn't even race conventional forks.
Right.
So,
yep.
It depends on, of course, there's a lot of things that conventional forks did better, and there's a bunch of things they didn't do as good. But the whole evolution of the bikes, I mean, if it's just a trend, it would have been a short-lived trend, right? People would have come back. I mean, it's not purely a marketing ploy that Honda.
At this point, it's not
purely that. It's like this thing I said about, let's say the whole Yamaha thing with that mass centralized engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you right now going to say that that's not good? It's too soon, right?
Right, right.
I mean, that look at how much evolution has gone into. Look at the hours of racing and testing and the evolution of the current motocross bike, and then they do something like that. I mean, it almost, people expect for those technical developments to produce black and white results, right?
Right.
And that's almost unrealistic. This stuff is so refined that even if there was, I think even some of the benefits of the Yamaha, whether it be, you know, if the mass is more centralized, which I believe it is, and they're able to change direction. But let's say the engine hanger ties to the chassis a little bit different. Let's say the chassis rigidity is different. Let's say the weight bias, you know what I mean, all that stuff. Let's say the CG, you know, and then you might have to go back and compensate for some of that stuff for it to be ultimately, for it to even realize its full potential, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why.
And to expect Yamaha to have done that in a production development process without work spikes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a negative of not having work spikes. It's almost impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you're not out there with the top guys and then every week coming with a new chassis or engine hangers or changing the weight. I mean, look how tied their hands were, and they still tried something big out of the box.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, good point.
It's not, you know, don't oversimplify how, you know, do you remember when Cannondale, and everybody goes, oh, Cannondale, they know how to make aluminum frames, and I'm not bagging on Cannondale, but I think if you went back and talked to anybody in that off the dirt bike development process at Cannondale, they probably, all of them would have said, I mean, theoretically, all that stuff sounded great, right?
Right.
Fuel injection, turn it around. In reality, the thing kind of flopped. And why was that? Because I think they oversimplified what the performance of current mass production motocross bikes coming out of Japan actually is.
Yeah, it's crazy, too, when you think about the fact, like, when Yamaha introduced its aluminum frame on the two-strokes in 05, you know, we were told as mechanics that it had the exact same characteristics as the steel frame. Everything measured out, everything was the same. But, well, guess what? We got on the track, and it wasn't.
Have you ever heard almost same?
What's that?
Have you ever heard, after those guys say it's exactly the same, have you ever heard them say, well, it's almost the same?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that almost thing is, sometimes those almost gaps
almost,
are pretty big.
Yeah, almost as a point of view, right? But, you know, so the riders struggled with it, and we ended up, you know, there was webbing on the inside of the frame and outside of the frame with the cones, the aluminum frame cone. We put, like, super thin sheets of aluminum over some of those cones and welded them shut.
Yeah.
And you would not believe the difference that made. It made it in a negative way. Okay, it didn't work out. But every rider, we had three of them that got on that bike, was like, this thing sucks. And I was blown away by the fact that a tiny piece of aluminum welded in a few spots to close those cages up would affect a bike that much. And it is.
Yeah, I mean, it is how sensitive these things are. Like,
yeah,
where the chassis flex, how much they flex. I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert. I mean, there's all these really deep level specialized engineers that
right.
are involved with car these engine management systems or carburation systems or engine cylinder castings or frames. But I mean, I've seen engineers come over here and grind on gussets and drill holes in gussets and
mm-hmm.
and you're looking at that going, give me a break, right?
Right.
But like you say, it there's a saying that as soon as you think you know it all, you really don't. And and there's a lot to all of that.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, you know, for Yamaha, like you said, for Yamaha to develop that bike in the age of no works bikes is amazing because of all those
yes.
changes, you know?
Yes.
And there isn't a team out there that doesn't play with motor hangers and motor brackets and raising lower them and changing the thickness, and that makes a big difference.
Yep.
And it's just
That's
crazy
right.
to think about such a small stuff and how it plays into effect. And
right.
you know, you're kind of the guy back then to think about all that stuff. So
right.
But anyways, we've 47 minutes and we haven't even talked about your racing career.
Mine's pretty simple. I came up from a family of seven and everybody was academically smart except for my younger brother and I, and then we ended up going to a trade school because we bombed out. We were whatever side of your brain works for academic didn't work for us.
Yeah.
So I went to a trade school after college because all I could think about was riding dirt bikes, and then I wanted to work and learn about dirt bikes, and
mm-hmm.
then I started working as a Honda mechanic in dealerships for three or four dealerships.
Is this in Southern California?
And then it wasn't.
Are you born and raised?
Say again?
Are you born and raised in SoCal? Is this Southern California?
Yeah, I'm actually at the house I was born and raised at. I'm taking care of my 96-year-old father today.
Oh, okay. So,
I've got a poster, or what is it? It's something. One of the piece of the snow fence from the Carlsbad. I think it was a Grand Prix in 1973. still stapled up in the garage.
Nice.
Hang 10 or something. Hang 10 USDP.
Right. So, okay. So, how'd you get the job at Honda?
So my instructor from trade school, he thought he had two, not star students, but he had two guys that he thought would be a good fit to manufacturers. And his name was Pat Owens. He actually used to work at Triumph out at, I think it's Johnson Motors out in the other side of Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
He was a service manager involved in dirt track also. He was kind of a race team connected guy. And so then he placed some of his somewhat star students. Mark Porter was one of them.
Oh yeah,
for a good friend of mine, and we went to school together. We were buddies. We were dirt track and motor. Mark Porter and I were. Yeah, we went to trade school together.
Mark Porter is a great guy.
He's a great guy.
He was always a good
one
guy.
One of my favorites.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's I tell everybody I work with, you know, that if they don't hold up their end of the deal at Honda, I'm like, going, man, I'm telling you, the guy at Yamaha, man, they're not sleeping today, and I know one of them.
Yeah, really. When you guys sit around a beer, how hard is it then drink some beer? How hard is it for neither one of you to tell each other what's going on?
No, you know, I mean, of course, he's got to be ethical, I've got to be ethical, but there's a deep friendship there, and not
yeah.
that we see each other or talk all the time, but
right.
we go way, way, way back, and I did something for Pat Owens last year. I brought some Honda Heritage vintage bikes out to one of his mm-hmm. events he was having, and Mark Porter showed up, and
it's
pretty easy for us to bench race about
I bet.
About bikes, and, you know, he's an enthusiast. He was racing a Bultaco, I was racing a BSA, and he's a good rider, I'm telling you. I was probably a little bit better motocross guy, knock on wood, and he was a way better dirt track guy than I was flat track guy.
Wow, the things you don't know about Mark Porter.
Oh, no. Yeah. Telling you, Porter's a good rider. He's, remember at Saddleback when he used to have the Widowmaker, whatever that was, the big hill climb?
Yeah, the Suicide Hill?
Yeah. He used to have, remember the big, the board, and everybody had their name? There wasn't that many guys on there, and he used to be one of them.
I never went to Saddleback before. I grew up in Canada, so I just read it in the magazines.
Oh.
Yeah.
But anyway, Porter got placed at Yamaha,
yep.
and I did an interview at Yamaha with that. At that time, the race team manager was Kenny Clark.
Yep.
And it was for Mike Hartwig, I think a guy out of Michigan. And he had to interview five guys. I was one of them because Pat Owens recommended me and Mark had already been placed there. And then there was Dudak and a bunch of guys internally at Yamaha. And he ended up hiring a really good guy, Dudak. Is it Don Dudak?
Yeah. Right.
And so he ended up being Hartwig's mechanic. So then I stayed working at dealerships. And then the next race team thing that opened up, Honda was expanding their effort. And so then I did an interview there. And I remember the interview was the best. Well, I've never done a resume, but they wanted me just for a shop mechanic because they had a group of seven riders. It was Marty Smith and Staten and McDougall and Bauer and... I think Mickey Bone and Rich Eierstadt.
Yeah.
I'm probably forgetting somebody. But
right.
I had to rebuild all the practice bikes. And so they threw a transmission in front of me, and they said, okay, put it together, all the shims and clips. And, of course, you worked on XL Hondas and CR. Well, it was Elsinore's at the time, Hondas. Right. And so I could do that. So then they hired me, and I was the shop guy.
And that was it.
Right away. Next week, I couldn't believe you could get actually a salary because everything I did at a dealership was on commission.
Right, right.
And then I was like, man, I mean, I got to work my ass off because they're going to give me a check no matter what, and I don't want them to think they're getting cheated, you know?
Yeah, yeah, funny. And what year would this have been, Dave? What year
was it? That was 74.
74, okay.
Then there was a couple guys that got injured that that I started working with on the national circuit. John Rosasteel was a mechanic at the time. Roy Turner was a mechanic at the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, this big truck came off the national circuit, was going to go off of the Trans Am, and then they go, okay, you're going to work on Billy Grossi's bike for the support class of the Trans Am.
Uh-huh.
So I went out and did that right before he went to Suzuki.
Right.
Sugar Bear. So then that was in 74. Then in 75, I worked on Rich Eierstadt's bike for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, Pierre Karsmaker was on the team. You know, so they had a big turnaround. So I was on the national circuit, and then they had a deal in '76. So, you know, and I was still kind of working with all the riders for practice bikes and race bikes, and
yeah, filling
you know,
in wherever,
whatever they were using. Yeah. And then anyway, Marty and I got hooked up for the '76 season, but he was the reigning 125 national champion,
mm-hmm.
and John R. was in the 125 class, and John R. was his mechanic. And so then I was like, there's no way I want the number one guy. I mean, I just don't. I didn't
earn
it.
I'm not ready for this.
I'm brand new here. I'd rather not, you know. And John R. was like, no, you just got to keep the bike together, and Marty wins everything. You don't even got to worry about it. So the first race I went to was Hangtown, and not only did we break down, but Hannah beat us both motos.
So wonderful.
Yeah, it was great. I've been scarred for life still to this day. It affected me.
Hey, when John R. told you that, was he rubbing his face down with Windex on a rag?
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, he's my hero. John R. is my hero, and I tell him that all the time. I'd say he's humble enough that he doesn't like to hear it, but he's really one of my. I think John R. and Cliff White are the best mechanics in the industry.
John, I worked with John R. at Yamaha when I was there.
Yeah.
He retired. I think my second year I was there, but
I was probably credited for maybe being creative or trying a lot of stuff and cutting chassis up and
mm-hmm.
moving shocks, and I'd want to do all the big developments, but those two guys are so meticulous. I never had that level of patience. I mean, I can tell you their bikes when they went to the line. I mean, that's as close to perfection as you're ever going to get.
Yeah, but it was funny because in the suspension world, when I worked with John R., he was one of those guys where he was like, it doesn't matter, dude. Just turn the throttle. Like he didn't try to outsmart himself. Like he kind of knew.
I would say that. I don't know how he is as a development guy. I didn't really work with him in that capacity. I mean,
right.
He was just starting to do suspension stuff in the 70s, and he was trying to make the Showa stuff work, and I was kind of just taking the stuff off and not using it, throwing it in the trash, and I'd be running the Girlings, or I'd be running the Marazachis or the KYBs, and,
uh-huh.
you know, Showa, you know how all these Japanese companies, they have all their Kirtitsu or their vendors, and
mm-hmm.
the Showa, you know, Honda had Showa, they had Kihin for carburation instead of Makuni, and then they had... But the Showa stuff didn't work for a lot of years until it worked really, really good.
Right.
But in the year, you know, I worked with John R. when he was trying to, he was trying to make stuff that really wasn't engineered very well. Really high quality stuff, but just not engineered very well.
And right, and he was already into it.
It was the beginning years of Showa, you know, trying to develop that technology in motocross, and there was a learning curve.
Right. So, okay, so you're working with Marty, and this kid named Bob Hanna comes up, and, I mean, it was must have been pretty...
It was Bob against Marty. I mean, I didn't like Bob then. I mean, I you know, not that I didn't respect the other top racers. I mean, I idolized DeCoster. Right. I mean, I thought every time I just mesmerized when I watched Roger come over and race the Trans Am. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh my God! You know, I mean, I couldn't even hardly watch the bike I was working on.
Right, right, there he is.
And you know, but Roger would come around. I mean, Marty beat Roger in a few Trans Am races, mm-hmm. and you know. Roger would come over and congratulate you. I mean, he was always kind of a class act, where Bob, I always just thought he was a cocky little shit, you know?
Yeah, he did.
But, I mean, ultimately, Bob ended up later in years, you know, after he was kind of over maybe his peak, and but he still had a lot of races to win, and he had a huge fan base, and I hired Bob in the early 80s. Roger and I kind of lobbied for him.
Yeah, 83.
Just because he had that piss and vinegar attitude that we were trying to, you know, Bailey and O'Mara, we had enough talent, but we wanted that gunfighter mentality in the team. So
well, yeah, but from people I talked to, like Bob Oliver at Yamaha, I mean, Hanna in 83 was the fastest guy. He just got hurt. He apparently, I was a kid, but he was by far the best guy that year. And it's a kind of a travesty. He never won a title for Honda, but he was blazing fast, right?
He helped Honda win quite a few titles. It just didn't have his name on him.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, I didn't have to put out a sign that said, "Let Brock by," and that's not a slam against McCarty, but I mean, the companies wanted to win.
Right.
And Bob was one of the best guys they have. Unfortunately for Bob, we nicknamed him Brittle Bob. I mean, that guy would break bones at that period of time without even falling off his motorcycle.
Oh, really?
But he was the fastest guy, and then at the end of the series, he'd be healthy, and I don't know how many times Bailey, you know, I'm like, Bob, I mean, you're coming back, Millville, Minnesota, the last race of the year, I'm going to need your help. And he'd write down a list of all of his sponsors, and he's, you know, and here's what happens if I win, and this is what you're going to pay me, and you tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it. And he says I still owe him some of that money, and I swear I think I paid him. But.
Was it true that after he let Bailey buy at Millville, he just rode off into the woods? Is that true?
I guess I heard that story.
Who knows if it was true? Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know what Bob did? I had a sign at that race, and I was like, come on, you know, and he was pulling away. And he pulled away, and it was like, come on, you know.
Yeah,
that's something maybe Jean-Michel Bale would have done, but not Bob. I mean, we had a deal, right?
Yeah.
And then in the last turn, in the last lap, before the checkered, I'd already written him off as winning. He drops his bike. and he gets up slowly, and he tucks his jersey in, and he's redoing his kidney belt. I mean, he makes it obvious to everybody there that, that he's throwing the race for Bailey, right?
Right, right, right.
And, you know, so he made his point, but, you know, I don't know about riding into the hills. I honestly don't remember him being that pissed about anything as long as he got paid.
As long as he got paid. I mean, just from the guys I talked to, those years, early years at Honda, he was blazing fast. He just got hurt, you know.
He was blazing fast.
So let's go back.
I mean, more of an outdoor than supercross, but still.
Yeah, let's rewind a bit. When you were Marty's mechanic, Marty Smith's mechanic, one of the more incredible feats that doesn't get talked about enough, I think, is the fact that Marty did the 125 Nationals and the 125 GPs in 1 year, flying back and forth in the days of traveling when it wasn't easy. What was that like?
I think there's three things when I think of Marty. One is I don't think there was ever a bad picture of Marty Smith ever. I mean, that guy had the best style, so naturally talented, gifted. I mean, I don't think he ever had the... I don't think he trained like Hanna. I don't think he had the drive like Hanna, but, I mean, he never had to before Hanna. I mean, Marty was just a natural, and his idea of we'd finish a national that in 76, and he's like, Dave, just, you know, you want to go testing? I got suspension. Olean's guy, we can do this. And he's like, yeah, you can go ride my bike. You know what I like. Go ahead and you fix it up, and it'll be fine, you know? But I would say, that whole European thing was a gross error on Honda's part, I would think.
Really?
It's all they had, and of course they wanted to get some recognition or I think it was just naivety. It was naive for Honda to think that, you know, that a guy like Marty, I mean, not only did Marty not like Europe very much because it didn't have ice and the Coke and Baskin-Robbins ice cream and,
girls.
You know, he didn't like it. I mean, it wasn't right. San Diego.
Yeah, yeah.
Marty liked San Diego, and so that was probably one misjudgment. That was a big deal. He didn't like going over there. He wasn't happy when he was there, and
right.
He didn't like the way people talked to him, and, you know, they didn't idle. They didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't praise him like they did here, you know. They didn't. And then the other thing was our bike worked here in the States. The Hondas were very lightweight, very light switch fast, but, you know, smooth tracks, right? I mean,
right.
Mid-Ohio and stuff. You go to Europe, oh, my God, the bikes, the power bands, the Suzukis were better. Everybody had reed valves, and they had broader power bands, and they had longer travel, and they had stiffer chassis, and they had equipment that was developed for those racetracks. Our bikes fell apart in Europe.
Yeah,
that was the other thing.
He
so
mentioned that.
I would say
yeah.
that was a misjudgment on our part to think that he could actually handle all that travel and be effective trying to race both championships.
But it's pretty amazing.
That was one.
But it's pretty amazing that a guy did that. Right?
It was pretty amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Although you were there. You were more probably.
Well, you know, John R. was in Europe, and probably the best story I have of that year was that you know, John R. went to Europe. I was his mechanic here in the States. And Marty really liked but, you know, he didn't. It was the first year that Honda had a reed valve engine that was called the Type 1. They had that in Europe. But still, it had a lot of power, but it was a real short power. And Marty was a real, you know, 125 and over rev kind of a guy, right? Where in the bumps where it didn't fall out of the power, the bike would pop a lot. And Marty really liked the engine that he won the championship on in 74 and 75, which had a case reed engine very similar to what Suzuki came out with the first RMs. So, in any case, you know, he was getting beat in the States, and he was getting beat in Europe, and then he really wanted me to build a bike that had that old motor in it. So we did, and of course, I had Donnie Emler did the cylinder and made the pipe. I had all this freedom. Nobody was really looking. All the engineers, the Japanese engineers, were in Europe. And Emler put this big giant carb on it and had this big flipper cone pipe and poured the cylinder, and I did all the chassis work. I had Girlings in the back, and I had Marzocchi forks in Showa outer stanchions in the front.
Yeah.
And Marty was like, even when he was in Europe, he was telling me, like, oh, is that bike done? The bike done? He really wanted to ride that bike. It hadn't even been tested. It had not been tested before Mid-Ohio.
Right.
So he comes here for the Grand Prix, and he goes out and practice. All the engineers are there, and
yeah.
Of course, I'm like, hey, I got the bike there, but it's a token. I mean, I don't want him to ride the bike. If it ever broke, I mean, that'd be my last race. And so he goes out on the bike he'd been racing in Europe, didn't even give it a one lap, two laps, all muddy, comes in, gets on his bike that we built, and he's happy, comes in, yeah, things great. So that was it, right? Changed the jetting a little bit, or I don't know what.
Right.
And he goes out there and wins both motos against Gaston Rayer and Hanna. So I remember one of the engineers looking at the bike after the race, and he's doing a race report like you've seen him do, right?
Yeah.
You know, what gearing and what jetting. And there wasn't one thing that was a Honda that he put on the race report, right? I mean, because the engine was modified, the pipe wasn't Emler Japan
had
HRC.
40-millimeter carb on it or whatever?
We had a magnesium carb off a 250, which was a 37-millimeter oval bore.
Yeah.
And everybody was running, you know, everybody running like a 30 or a 32, right?
Right.
Anyway, that was, I was so scared the bike was going to break. And, you know, but anyway, I remember the guy doing the race report, and I remember him saying it's not even a Honda.
did you work for Marty when he won the 500s?
I did.
You did?
And that was a close race between him and Hanna.
Yep.
Came down to Gainesville, Florida, and Hanna's throttle cable came out of the slide.
Oh, McCarty.
And it wasn't any fault of McCarty. I mean, it was... And then, ironically, that same year, Marty was much more dominant in the 250 class but broke a transmission in, I believe, Red Bud, Michigan, mm-hmm. and Tony DiStefano won the championship. And if you ask him to this day, that's probably the thing he feels cheated or robbed the most. He wanted that bad.
Yeah, I did one of these with him, and I believe that's exactly what he said. He said
he wanted to win the 250, and he was majorly bummed. There was another championship that Tripes almost won. I mean, you know, later in the 70s when maybe we weren't the dominant team. Well, we weren't the dominant team, but Tripes came back and almost won a Supercross series, and it was a 78 or 79, and he broke a transmission at the Coliseum, and I remember both those guys, to this day, they've never forgotten it. Like,
right.
So.
Typical riders.
Yeah.
So after Marty, what did you do after you wrapped up working for
him?
Well,
you know, Marty got injured late in the 70s, mm-hmm. in 79. He broke his pelvic bone in the Coliseum and got run over, and it was a really bad deal.
Infamous
took him a long
crash.
Time to get him off the track, and I think that was the end of a competitive racing. I mean, Marty still raced a few more years, but Marty, there was a lot of pain associated with that injury, and he was in the hospital and was dislocated for a long period of time, and whether or not physically he was ever the same, but I think even emotionally, mentally, I don't think Marty ever wanted to put himself in a position of being in that situation again.
Right.
So then, you know, Honda was getting serious about bad timing for Marty, but then in the 80s, they were going to have a 10-year commitment for full engineering, works bike development, motocross.
Right.
And so then, you know, Marty and Honda were going to part ways because they were hiring like a whole new fleet of riders. I think that, I have no idea how the negotiations went. I don't think that Honda wanted Marty to go away, but he got a better deal somewhere else.
Suzuki,
But I ended up knowing that he was going to go somewhere else, and Japan had kind of a secret test with Roger. Even though he was kind of over the hill, they wanted Roger to help lead development. Folks and mm-hmm. and help mentor some of the young guys for Europe, Malherbe and Graham Noyce, and help development of ProLink and HPP. No, HPP wasn't around yet, but cartridge forks were, and you know, water cooling and all that stuff, right?
Right.
And I idolized Roger, and I'm not trying to be a groupie here because he's a very, very good friend, but it's a weird thing to say, but even when I love the image of Roger over here racing the Trans Ams and all the other Europeans there.
Right.
There was Ben Allberg and Sylvan came a couple of years, and, you know, there was all those guys. Gaston, I mean, not Gaston, but...
Joel.
Robert. But even after that, you know, Sylvan Gabors came for a few years, and Ben Allberg and all these oh man, it was great.
And they would just
like it. Even though I was working for Marty, and at least Marty was a gracious guy. Marty was always a class act. Marty never rubbed anything in your face. I mean, he was the most likable guy that ever dominated racing. And but you know, I never even liked Hannah and Roger Hannah and Smitty beating Roger. I mean, because I knew it would just be the end of the era that the Europeans wouldn't come over here as soon as the Americans were winning their own championships.
That was it, right?
So,
yeah.
And then, so his last year of racing was going to be 1980, and he was going to be on Honda. And I don't know if grovels or begs. I don't know which one's more accurate, but I was like, Roger, I'll do anything to work on your bikes in Europe. And I probably had the most seniority and.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So you did a whole year there in 1980.
I went to Europe. I went to Europe with Roger. I lived in his house with him for half. That was the best year I ever had in racing was Roger's mechanic. Nothing. I mean,
really?
I shouldn't say that because the whole Marty and I, we had a great run in the 70s and a great relationship. But it's like being in Europe and experiencing and all the travel and all the different countries. And,
and
it was just heroin as far as working on motorcycles. I mean, mm-hmm. the development. I mean, there was no corporate. There was a workshop in his garage, and Roger was there with me. I mean, we'd be there 12 o'clock, 1, 2 in the morning, and I'm going, isn't this guy racing the next day? I mean, he's nuts, you know? He's a very dedicated, hard-driving, hard-working guy, and I'd like to think that I was somewhat the same, and I had a great time working with him in Europe.
Well, even the Suzuki guys say that he's, you know, he's leaving for KTM, by the way. I don't know if you heard that news.
Yeah, I know that.
But even the Suzuki guys said on the mill and the lathe, he's a master. He can come up with stuff.
They tease him. I go in. They let me, I don't know why, some of the Japanese executives let me go in and say hi and go in the truck. And
yeah.
He's always doing his little MacGyver acts, right? He's putting little riveting things on the air box and fixing this and that. He's very handy.
So, yeah, you wonder.
And he was then. I mean,
yeah.
I couldn't cut threads on a lathe. I mean, I kind of jerry-rigged a lot of stuff on a mill and a lathe, but
yeah.
Here there was a writer that would cut his own threads. I'm like, give me a break. I can't even do that, and I'm the mechanic.
yeah, exactly. It'd be like watching, when I worked for a writer, it'd be like watching him adjust the valves on a four-stroke.
Exactly.
Chad Reed's not doing that.
What
about, and you won a GP. He won the final GP of his career that year.
Should have won, too.
He should have
won the one just before that, which was in
Did you let him down, Dave? Did you let him down, Dave?
You know what? He broke down, and I don't think I've ever forgiven myself. I don't think. I want to believe I didn't let him down, but it was a Namur. I don't think they even have it anymore, but
no,
it was in Belgium, so it was his home country,
right.
And he was hauling ass. And it's a lot of riders are scared of Namur because it goes through the trees. It's really high speed, and
right.
It's kind of very dangerous, actually.
Yep.
And then it's in the center of town, and it pops up on top of this hill, and there's a cafe up there in a soccer field. And
yeah.
But he was leading, and he got water in the carburetor, in the slide stuck, and he still tried to keep it going. And anyway, I don't know. There was a part we had for extreme conditions. It was a little rubber booty that went on the top of the carburetor.
Mm-hmm.
That I did not have on my carburetor, and I've never let myself live it down to this day.
Way to cost him a GP win, Dave.
So he DNF'd, and then he went out, which was tricky. The last race in Luxembourg, you know, it was a championship still between Lackey and Mahler, the Belgian guy. Roger was helping Mahler a lot. I mean, Roger was really tutoring Mahler to win the title.
Right.
I mean, he was trying to help Neuss, but Neuss had the English thing going on. I don't think he was quite as close to Roger, the Belgian thing, as for sure Mahler was.
Wasn't Mahler kind of a dick, though? Or I guess not to Roger, right, because it's Roger de Coster, but apparently he was infamous for being really hard to work with. No?
You know, Bale could be accused of that. Mahler, I mean, you know, everybody always says that about the French in general, right? And I think it depends on the individual. You know, I mean, people used to say that about Europeans, but I don't remember anybody that raced against Roger that thought he was a dick, right? Except
right.
for Hannah, because Hannah, you know, he thought everybody was stealing his money.
Right.
But I don't know Mahler. No, Mahler was never. He was a very class guy. I don't know. I never had that impression. Now Bale was different. Bale had a lot of guys that didn't think he was warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, we'll get to Bale.
But now again, on a personal level, Bale, I've never done more with a rider. I mean, we would go bowling. We would go out to dinner. We, mm-hmm. you know what I mean. But on when it came to a career in racing, I mean, he was, I don't know, self-centered. But Bale, oh man, he was a handful.
You know what was funny was I had Bale. I did one of these with Bale. It was one of my favorite ones I've ever done. I got a hold of him when he was at Roger's house like a year ago.
Yeah.
And I got Stanton on the line, and we did a three-way.
Oh, no!
We did a three-way call, and get this. They both acted like they loved each other.
I'll make a statement. It's because Stanton, you know, a couple things happened. Stanton retired at 25 years old. Do you know that?
Yeah, I know. Super young.
And,
I thought 26, but yeah.
And, Bale was freaking good. Bale was naturally gifted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't need to say that. The guy had more talent than maybe anybody ever.
Right.
But we would go out early. I said that about all this testing. I mean, Stanton, if we came out, we were going to test before Southwicker. I mean, Stanton was always there, and he would train more. And him and O'Mara and Bailey, they would eat better. And they would, you know, they were religious. They were like the Pope, right?
Right.
And Bale, eat Twinkies in front of Stanton, and he would, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bale didn't like to do all the testing, and he didn't like people messing with his regime, which was get on a perfectly prepared bike from Cliff White and win races, you know. And that guy was a talented racer, but an unbelievably I don't know
stubborn?
How to say it. I mean, he could orchestrate a race, so the guy could read a race. I mean, he would be in the middle of the race and look at the guys up front and the guys in the back. Okay, maybe the fifth, maybe the 11th lap, I'll make my move, you know? I mean, Bale was incredible.
Yeah.
But Bale, in my opinion, was the reason that Stanton retired early, because there was so much tension in that team.
Yeah.
You could have cut it. You couldn't have cut it with a chainsaw.
And
Jeff, you know, Jeff was, he didn't have Bale's, but I mean, Jeff was a hard, he trained more, and he tried hard, he rode with his heart, right? He didn't, you know what I mean? He didn't necessarily ride with that manipulative, freaking calculating, mischievous, freaking ulterior motive like Bale, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then Bale admitted on the show that, you know, a lot of that drinking Coke and eating Kit Kats was done on purpose in front of Jeff.
Everything was done on purpose with Bale.
Right.
There was not one thing that was not calculated.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm thoroughly convinced that, that guy was, I got to be where when the guy would call me, it was never what I thought the phone conversation was. Literally on the phone, I'd have to go, now, what is this really going to turn into? And how am I going to get jacked up on the deal?
What's he getting to here? Yeah, exactly. And then,
he was manipulative. I mean, he could control what I was going to do, and Stan, I mean, he was a little bugger.
And Dan Bentley and Cliff were going at it. And,
man, I'm telling you, those guys were about ready to fight each other.
I know. I heard the stories, and then like...
I hired a guy, a mechanic, Ron Heben.
Right.
Not that he's not a good guy, not that he's not a good mechanic, but I hired him purely to break the ice in the team.
Because
Ron Heben's a good time, Charlie. Take everybody to dinner, buy a drink, have a laugh. Doesn't matter what, right?
Yeah.
But I mean,
these guys,
you couldn't get a laugh out of that team if you had, you know, freaking Steve Martin sitting there.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, we'll get to that. We're all right. Well, hey, let's wrap this up, Dave, right now, because we could go on and on about Bale, Stanton. I still want to get to, you know, Hannah, Bailey, O'Mara, Motocross of Nations. I mean, where do I begin?
Yeah, you know what? We got to get back to this whole thing. I mean, in theory, not that I'm a great storyteller. I'm sure you're going to have to edit and clean this whole mess up. But when you start talking about the Americans and how poor their results were in the late 70s going to Europe, and then in the early 80s where the AMA couldn't get a team to go, and Bell Ray and Roger and
Dick Miller, I think, right?
Dick Miller is actually, I think, the guy that spearheaded it. I mean, they put together an effort to, and it was basically an unknown team that won in Europe. So starting from the 80s with Trophy in 81, and then Magoo winning four motos in 82, and then Honda had a pretty good run all the way through McGrath, and that was like a... That was almost like over a 10-year period. Well, that was more like a 13-year period after that.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about the Rabbi fork, that you had. Where do we start? Okay,
all right.
Let's do a part two as soon as we can. I'll be in touch here with you, and thank you for doing the Trans World Motocross PTO Sports.
It was fun for me, and thanks for calling, Steve.
All right, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah, talk to you.
Bye. All right, folks, that's part one of the BTOsports.com Trans World Motocross podcast with Dave Arnold. Fascinating guy, tons of information, and look for part two as soon as I can get together with him. All right, thank you for listening.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as...
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. And, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course they did. Everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled pitch and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got this friend up in the atmosphere. Another reason not to fear the sky. Not tonight.